Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and welcome to a special Friday night edition of Movie Buff Specialist, our 20th episode. We're a fifth of the way through this. Who would have thought we'd ever actually get to this point? 20 movies in after tonight, and 80 left to go of our favorite 100 movies of all time. Hope you've been enjoying this countdown, and if you haven't been, I don't know why you're watching episode number 20. Good for you. But here we are, number 81 on each of our lists. Tonight we're talking Who Framed Roger Rabbit and 12 Monkeys. Two movies that definitely have some thought behind them, but could be considered two of the more fun movies that we've done on this podcast, at least in the same episode, probably dating all the way back to Tropic Thunder and The Dark Knight. So we're back tonight. For anybody who hasn't been paying attention, I'll say this right off the top. John and I will not be back again until June 21st. So we're taking a little bit of time off after this, a little break after episode number 20 here, mainly because I'm just not going to be around. And that's why we're doing midnight on the East Coast on a Friday night. So thanks for tuning in if you're here for this. Anyway, John, 12 Monkeys, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? You like one a lot more than the other, and I feel the same way. How we doing?
We're doing good. Looking forward to some late night discussion of a couple of animal themed movies here.
I know it's nice when you have two movies that are have an animal in the name, and yet neither one really has anything to do with animals, because one is an animated rabbit and the other one has nothing to do with monkeys really at all. Let's start off with 12 Monkeys, though. I feel like 12 Monkeys, Terry Gilliam, while he is one of those directors who definitely has a big following, I don't think you can argue that a Disney movie with a Disney ride, even though it wasn't a Disney movie at the time and they just acquired the rights, is probably the bigger movie. So we'll save Who Framed Roger Rabbit for a second here. But let's start up with 12 Monkeys, which is your number 81.
Yeah, and it's one of those movies that it's so evocative of that 90s sci-fi feel. We talked about it with a few of the other movies we discussed. We talked about it with Delicatessen. We talked about it with Dark City. There was something really cool happening with sci-fi in the late 80s going into the 90s. And it kind of lasted until we hit 99 and The Matrix happened and kind of changed the face of sci-fi again. And part of that just came down to the more in-your-face style of the filmmaking that was going into sci-fi. We had a lot of different, like, fast cuts to really zoomed in shots. And Terry Gilliam, I think, kind of takes what he built with Brazil and presents it in a much more cohesive manner with 12 Monkeys, and really gives us this interesting take on a global pandemic and how people would go back and try to fix it.
Yeah, I don't know if I actually prefer this one or Brazil. That's a tough call for me. I enjoy both of them, but you can see that I do agree with you that he 100% is just going and expanding on whatever he had done with Brazil. I hope that you're frozen and I'm not, because I'm seeing a freeze here, and I hope it's not me because I've been talking. But he totally just goes ahead and he expands on what he did with Brazil with 12 Monkeys, with the underground and people having to live underground and what's going on. There's a lot of really interesting decisions that are being made here. And I do think that Terry Gilliam, we talked about it with Delicatessen, but Terry Gilliam kind of invented this style of genre with Time Bandits and Brazil and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. He really kind of invented the whole thing. And I know that, John, I think you're back now. No worries. I just kept talking. But I all I was saying was that I feel like Terry Gilliam kind of invented this genre. I don't know if I prefer Brazil or if I prefer 12 Monkeys. I think they're similar movies, but they're different. And it's more of, do you appreciate the chaos, or do you want that twist ending? What do you want? I might actually like Brazil a little bit more, just because I feel like Brazil's having a little, 12 Monkeys is definitely having fun, but I feel like Brazil is just straight fun. Mm-hmm. And I feel like 12 Monkeys, Brazil has a lot of random in it, but it has the random and the whole movie is random, where 12 Monkeys will have some random in it that kind of, to me, feels out of place because this movie isn't random. This movie feels like it's very well thought out, feels like the story is very specifically following a certain path. Characters are acting in certain ways. And then you get those kind of like weird Jean-Pierre Jeunet characters who are sending him back in time. And I'm like, some of the, what they're doing just feels too out there just for the sake of being weird and out there.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that opinion of it. But to me, it really helps to build up this idea that our narrator is, I mean, once again, we have this unreliable narrator, and this time it's because he's questioning his sanity the entire movie. Whereas there are other time travel movies where, and this is kind of one of the big things, I really do like time travel. I like the way when time travel is presented in a way that is very logical and makes a lot of sense within the universe. I don't care if it makes sense scientifically, but as long as it follows its own rules within universe, I really like it. This movie does that. It's also weird that we're talking about a Zemeckis movie in the same week we're talking about time travel again.
Yeah.
But the time travel in this is put into question really early in the film, mm-hmm. because as soon as he goes back, the first time we see James in the past, he's in a mental asylum.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we're questioning, oh, is he making all this stuff up? Or did everything we see preceding these events happen? Or was this all in his head?
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to how Brazil ends. So spoilers if you haven't seen Brazil, but with Jonathan Pryce kind of sitting there, and it's like all of these images, and he's got the Malcolm McDowell machine on. I can't think of what it's called, but it's this idea that yes, this story is cohesive, and yes, the ending does feel like it makes sense with the entire story, and that this is what would happen, but we don't actually know, because he is shown in a mental asylum. This guy who keeps communicating with him claims that he took out his tooth, and now he's communicating in both timelines, which, you know, that's one of those things that raises a big question. And the entire movie is running around with his psychologist, well, or psychiatrist, whichever it is. But in real life, I mean, that's probably your main interaction. So maybe that's what you're thinking. I don't know. I feel like there are a lot of doubts here, and there's a lot of doubts based on memory and him as a child watching this take place. And was that actually him in that scene, or was he just remembering something as a child back before he lost it, or somebody got killed and this is kind of signifying that was the end of him, and that was the end of his sane self and when his insane self started. So there's a lot of ways to take it, but if you take it at face value, it's still a very interesting science fiction story that doesn't feel like it goes too out of control with it. And I 100% agree with you. You know, I watch Lost and I love Lost, one of my favorite shows ever. People always rip on everything after season 3, even though that's when all the episodes are great, except for season 6. And all the episodes in 4 and 5 are amazing. And people will complain about the time travel and stuff. It's like, who cares? Like, if it makes sense in this, then therefore it makes sense. And I always love the whole argument of, well, it's not scientifically right or possible. That's an Interstellar argument, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. I have that as like an honorable mention movie, but it's the Interstellar argument of, well, that's not what a black hole was like. And you get that from like some guy sitting there on Twitter eating a bag of Cheetos. It's like, oh, have you ever been to a black hole? You experience a lot of black hole stuff. You've like gotten stuck in a black hole, and you can tell me that you wouldn't be able to make dust like that. Like, who the hell knows? And I think it takes the fun out of movies if you try to make it too sciencey. And 12 Monkeys does just what it needs to do to give you enough to not make it feel stupid, like a movie like Timeline, but to still keep you entertained and invested in, okay, what's going on and who's actually going to start this this pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, it's kind of funny because based on current theories of time travel, 12 Monkeys might be one of the closest representations of what time travel might actually exist. There was a study last year where a physicist said that time travel hypothetically is possible, but the latest quantum physics and everything has determined that there's no such thing as a time paradox, because everything that will happen if you go back to change an event, other events around it will correct to repair that paradox. And that's what we're seeing happen in 12 Monkeys with the time travel in this. But we don't know that until we get to the very end of the movie. Yep. And the psychiatrist makes the phone call and leaves a joke message, which is the message that instigated James going back to the past in the first place.
Yep. And then James ends up making the call and they figure out how to bring him the gun, which is how he ends up going through and getting killed. Like all of it. And that's, I love those types of moments because time travel can go wrong a lot of times. I mean, a movie like Back to the Future, which was on my top 100, and, you know, John had his theories about the time travel and such. John likes to rip the fun out of movies, you know, but sometimes. No, just kidding. But a movie like that, it's again, it's taking liberties with this. Where 12 Monkeys, I like that 12 Monkeys being an R-rated science fiction movie, Terry Gilliam, who's already established in this field, and it's coming out and it's trying to be a little bit more serious than a Back to the Future. Back to the Future was for 10 to 17 year olds. Like, let's be real. That's who that movie was meant for. 12 Monkeys is meant for adults. And so for adults to sit there and go, wow, oh, you're going to have to impress the people who were impressed by Back to the Future 10 years ago and now impress them in a way that they haven't seen before. And it's not going to be simple enough to just have them get back to where he's going. You have to subvert their expectations. And I love what this movie does the entire time, where you have David Morse with the long hair, you have Brad Pitt with the long hair, but we don't see Bruce Willis with the long hair until the end. And even then, we're still thinking, oh, good, David Morse is there. That's who he's going to end up shooting, and that's who's going to die here. And no, it's Bruce Willis. It's him seeing himself die, but it does a lot of cool things with the hair that makes you think it's going to be somebody else. And it all these little moments, like you said, the phone calls and all that, they all tie together, and they all wrap up nicely with a bow.
Yeah, and a lot of it just comes down to, I think it's very important how this movie establishes the rules of time travel early. We don't know how they're sending people back to the past. We don't have that explanation. We don't need that explanation. But what we do know is what James is saying the entire time. You can't change anything. Mm-hmm. And like, this is established just in the mission itself, because he's not going back to prevent this pandemic from happening. He is going back in order to capture the original, a copy of the original cell of the virus, so that they can develop a vaccine in the future. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to prevent it from happening because they know they can't. Mm-hmm. But what they're trying to do is help themselves in the present. And that's one of the great things about this movie, is that early on in the movie, when he's in the with the panel of doctors, he's talking about how 1996 is... the past. Obviously, it's taking place in 1990, 1996, the past, mm-hmm. and even now is like the past, and it's not the present. But then towards the end of the movie, he's accepting that the time he's living at that time is the present.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if anybody, did you watch Dark or no, the show Dark?
No, I have not
watched it. Okay, so Netflix has that show Dark, and that was good. That reminds me of 12 Monkeys, where it's Every time somebody feels like they've changed something, it hasn't changed, and the knot has just gotten tighter. And in Dark, they're always talking about the knot. And 12 Monkeys, that's what it is. It's a giant knot. And at every time it seems like the shoelace is coming untied, you're actually tightening a different part of the knot, and you don't realize you're doing it. And that's what I think is fascinating about this, because no matter what, Cole, he's always going to die in the airport. He's always, as a child, going to watch himself die. So now everybody else has to move forward and figure out what to do in order to be able to come back. Now, my one question mark with this whole thing, the one thing that doesn't make sense to me, and it feels like it was thrown in as kind of like a deus ex machina and whatever, is at the end of the movie, when he says he left the voicemail and the guy shows up and he says, you left that, I left that 30 seconds ago. And the guy goes, 30 seconds, 5 years or something like he says years. He doesn't say minutes or anything like that. He says years. How come he's still going to give Bruce Willis the gun there if years later, Bruce Willis isn't there anymore and they know Bruce Willis has died? Like, what's the, like, there's no alternative to that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Where, like, they're saying that in the future, they've decoded that they need to bring him the gun at that exact moment. But wouldn't they know that he's going to get killed because he's not in that future?
But if that's the case, then they have to establish it so that he does get killed. Because the whole point of the time travel in this is the way that time is perceived is that it's essentially predestined. And every time is very linear in this movie. And there's no way of changing it at all and altering. So every action that happens causes the reaction and so on and so forth, leading to the present that we saw in the future. And because of that, they have to send the gun back to fulfill the fact that he dies in that moment. Otherwise, Cole never goes. Cole's development is completely changed if he doesn't see himself dying. And then we don't get the plot of the movie because of it.
So they're almost setting him up to die and maybe knowing that they'll still figure something out eventually, but he still needs to see himself die. Otherwise, they're not going to figure out what's going on because we don't actually know. So while we get a conclusion on Cole's story and we get the conclusion that David Morse gets away with it and sits down next to the other lady and one of the main doctors who's there, we get that conclusion and we know that the virus is going to spread. We don't really get a conclusion on whether or not they're going to whether or not they're actually going to be successful in eradicating this or finding a vaccine in the future because of what Cole did. We kind of just get the closure there. And that's why it kind of leads those questions of, well, why would they bring the gun back if they know he's not going to die? But then if they are trying to do that, maybe they are successful in the future. You know, all the things that you might not be thinking about as 12 Monkeys ends, but if the more you dissect it, the more you're going to think about it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a great scene that kind of sums up all of the time travel in this movie. It's the Vertigo scene. Mm-hmm. So it's the scene when they're in the theater and they're watching Vertigo, and Cole says, you can't change the past. The movie doesn't change, but it feels like it did because you change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all this interpretation aspect of it. And hey, I think that's a really great thing as people who investigate movies to think about it. The fact that every time you watch a movie, you're coming into it with new experiences, so you might relate to it in a different way. But also just it really sums up everything to do with time travel in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that's fascinating, though, when they were talking about that, because I think about like the reason I wanted to make a top 100 list is because I've made one in the past. And how is it going to differ? You know, I made one in 2010 when I was in college, my first year of college. And then I made one in 2016 or something when I'd actually like graduated and moved to L.A. And then I make one now. And it is like something like Black Swan originally is in like my top 30 movies of all time. Now it's not even in like my top 30 movies of the last decade, you know? And so when he's saying that, it's this perception of, okay, that's the same exact movie that I watched in 2010, 2011, 2012 and felt a certain way about. But now I'm watching it now and I feel differently. Not because the movie changed, but because I changed. And it's almost like this whole circle is his life has to play out with a way that his perception changes from being the kid and not knowing what's going to end up happening, except that he sees somebody killed, to then having his perception be the one of, I am now the guy who has to get killed. And he never really realizes it until after he gets shot, because he's probably thinking, okay, David Morse is going to be the guy who ends up getting killed, that I end up seeing shot when I'm a kid. And that's like why everything happens. But he also knows that the virus does end up running through the entire place. So what's he supposed to do on that? Now, I did lose John again, so I'm just going to keep rambling here about 12 Monkeys until I get him back, which it looks like he just came back. I know he didn't hear a single thing I said, but he's back and he's moving, which is exciting times. John, how you doing over there? Everything okay?
I think so. Apparently, Friday night.
He just wanted to say Friday night. What did you say? Friday night's what?
It must get a little bumping and the internet starts getting used up around here.
Well, that's crazy to me. I guess you're still in Canada, so people probably aren't having bumping Friday nights like normal, but it's still crazy, man, at like 9:30 on a Friday night. You would think this would be like the most perfect internet in the world. It's like the best time to be on a college campus is a Friday night or Saturday night at like between like 10 and 2 in the morning.
Yeah, I think I live in an apartment building with, I think, like people our age. So they're not out bumping anymore. They're more chilling on a Friday night.
You think that they're actually like watching? Do you think they're watching this podcast and that's what's happening? They're sucking up all your bandwidth?
I hope
so.
I hope that's exactly what's going on.
That's exactly what's going on. But all I had said was the reality of perception there is it's like Bruce Willis' character has to have the perception as a child, and then that perception changes to where he's the one being shot. It's the exact same moment, just like the movie is the exact same. But now 20 years or 30 years or whatever have passed, and so it's being perceived differently by him, even though nothing in that moment has changed, down to the hair and the yells and everything. It's all the exact same.
Yeah, it really goes to show just how perspective works and how perspective can really work in a film, too, I would say, because that simple change of perspective from the dream Cole has where he's a child and like witnessing this stuff to him actually actively contributing to the events that are unfolding in front of him. It's just really interesting how Gilliam uses that in the film to make you kind of reflect on the film as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I liked what he does as well with, he has a lot of red herrings, you know, so we haven't even mentioned him or talked about him at all, but Brad Pitt in this movie nominated for an Oscar would have won if he wasn't up against Spacey for Usual Suspects, which could be like a top five performance ever. Like Spacey and the Usual Suspects, maybe one about his personal life, but that performance is ridiculous. And so Brad Pitt loses to that, but does get nominated. And this was the first time that I feel like Brad Pitt really got respect for being a good actor and not just a heartthrob like he was in Thelma and Louise. And but there's a lot of red herrings with this where the whole time you're thinking, okay, he's the son of a scientist. He's crazy. What's he going to actually end up doing? He's the leader of the 12 monkeys and you know he's nuts. And you know that Bruce Willis does say to him, like, you should, you know, you could kill everybody or whatever he says when he's high. And at the end of the day, all they wanted to do is release the animals. They actually did have good intentions and they just wanted to kind of get back at Christopher Plummer. That's all they were trying to do. But that's a great red herring because it's set up that Brad Pitt is going to be the mastermind of this whole thing. By the end of it, once again, he's got the long hair after having the short hair early on. And I mean, it's all really, really, really well done. And there's, you know, it's one of those movies. If you were to nitpick it, yeah, you could nitpick it. But you could nitpick any time travel movie. You could nitpick any sci-fi movie, probably with the exception of Space Odyssey. But you could nitpick everything else, but it's not worth it. You know what I mean? And it's one of those where it's like, just sit down and enjoy this ride and enjoy what Terry Gilliam is doing. Enjoy what paths he's trying to lead you down, where he's letting you back in. And this was actually only the second time I'd seen this movie. The first time I saw it, I was in high school. I hadn't seen it since high school, so a long time. And I remember liking it in high school, but not loving it. And this, I'd seen it because, you know, it's on every IMDb's top 250 and all that. And watching it this time, I was like, oh, like knowing what happens, knowing that's Bruce Willis, knowing Brad Pitt doesn't do this, knowing that it's David Morse. It's fun to watch because David Morse wasn't famous yet. He hadn't gained any type of notoriety, how easily they're able to hide him. And remember, this comes out the same year as Seven, where they're so easily able to hide Kevin Spacey just because they don't list him in the credits. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's funny to see what directors were kind of doing and what chances they were taking at a time like 1995, as opposed to 2000 and whatever, when Shutter Island comes out and all you had to do is watch the trailer to know that Leonardo DiCaprio was crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's just one of these things where it's like the point in the movie where it becomes where you start thinking that Cole encouraged Brad Pitt's character to unleash this disease on the world. It's just one of those like complete shocking moments where you just realize that there's this endless cycle in the time where it's like the virus that makes it so he has to go back never happens if he doesn't go back. It gets into those like more complicated time loops. And then we're just told that at the end of the movie, we find out that that's not the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting way to approach it. And it's set up in quite a way where there are hints laid out throughout the entire movie. And most of it happens in the asylum. Mm-hmm. Where there's like the guy who's talking with the Florida Keys and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see like, oh, this seems like way too important of a thing not to really come up again. But it is just this red herring then eventually, like, we're going to the Florida Keys, and it's like, okay, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, again, like, these are all writing decisions where, like, if you were to watch this movie and say, okay, that doesn't really mean anything. But when you're watching a mystery, that's the point. You know, Usual Suspects, like I said, came out the same year. Kevin Spacey wins the Oscar. That is way up on my rankings. I think it's in my top 25 or 30 or something like that. But that whole movie is a red herring. You know, like, there's nothing in that movie but red herrings. But I think what makes great mystery movies, and we'll talk about it with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a satire on this genre. Now, granted, 12 Monkeys is more of a sci-fi than a mystery, but it's still a mystery. And what makes a great mystery is this person who doesn't know what's going on, but they have enough, they know enough of what's going on. Dark City, he knows enough of what's going on, but he doesn't completely understand it. And when you're getting those red herrings, yeah, after you watch, you might say, oh, so that meant nothing. But in the moment, that meant so much to you. You were so sold on that. You were so sold that everything that was happening as you were being told, it meant so much. And then it's, you know, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled. And it's a snap of the fingers and it's gone. But, you know, that's the purpose of a movie like 12 Monkeys, is to give you all that. And I honestly believe that had it just been the typical Bruce Willis did start this, and had he not gone back and when it started, it wouldn't have been as good. It's better that it really had nothing to do with Bruce Willis the entire time. And that's why I actually think you telling me that they knew that he had to get killed in order for them to get whatever in the future, I actually think that makes it a better movie. The fact that Bruce Willis is literally unimportant to everything, yet he thinks that he is so important to everything going on.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when we get to this point where the phone, the message is left, and it's the recording and everything, that's kind of the point where you just realize nothing matters.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we've been told up to this point in the movie, we don't know if it has to do with anything whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like, if this is the statement here, and it was essentially just a practical joke, what else do we know about this future that's completely false?
Yeah.
And was just made up by someone joking around.
Yeah. And that's what starts, you know, and that's even like Brad Pitt's character. The whole 12 Monkeys thing is a joke. I mean, the whole thing is a joke. I mean, even the people who are there, they don't even know why it's happening or why they're a part of it, anything. So it's all like a joke. And it's all like, had she not made that phone call, would anything have happened? I don't know. But at the same point, I think that David Morse's character is so off of everybody's radar that doesn't even matter. He's going to do this no matter what.
And that's the other thing that I really love about it, is that nothing to do with the plot leads to this disease happening. Like, it's not like the influences of Cole going back and like jumping through time and stuff made it so that this disease gets released.
Mm-hmm.
There's no interaction with David Morse's character at all.
At all.
And it's not even like Brad Pitt's interacting with him or anything like that. No one's interacting with him. So nothing that we've seen leading up to that moment actually caused that to happen.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. I mean, that's a good point. And I think that's what makes a movie like this so interesting. And I think that's why it did build up this cult status, is just because so much of it just questions the whole idea of like, how meaningful is any of this? Like, what difference can one person make? You know what I mean? Like, and that's not to get you down. That's just meant to be. I think that's what this movie is asking. Is it saying, you know, I mean, and this is something we just went through a pandemic. Like, we can actually now answer this, but you know, it's the whole thing of, there's a lot of people who think we've done too much to try to mitigate stuff, just as much as there's people who don't think we've done enough. And obviously that's what we hear about more, because that is what's actually like going to be better ultimately, most likely, for society. But there's a lot of people who think we've gone too far and we've tried to play God with this thing. And we should have just kept it open. And, you know, it's like a wipe out who you have to wipe out. Like, I'm not saying that's my belief. I'm saying that's what people believe. And I think 12 Monkeys kind of gets into that of, you like, what do you think that this person is going to accomplish? And why do you so desperately need them to accomplish it?
Yeah, it's a lot of food for thought.
Yeah.
It's just funny how much more relevant movies like this do come to mm-hmm. be when we move forward. Because science fiction is a genre rooted in both human curiosity and fear mm-hmm. of where the world's going to go. And it gets kind of scary when we kind of start seeing the parallels between what's happening in the world now and what's happening in a movie from 26 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even Delicatessen's the aftermath, but it's mm-hmm. like, who knows? I mean, at the beginning of this, we were told that we were going to have meat shortages and stuff. We didn't, but that's yeah. what we were told all the time. So yeah. I don't know. You got anything else you want to say about 12 Monkeys before we move on to Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
No.
All right. So that's John's number.
It's a fun one. It's a little wacky. Terry Gilliam's wacky.
Yeah. He's a weird dude.
Don't let that stop you.
Don't let that stop you. I just realized Terry Gilliam is also 80 years old, which blows my freaking mind. But all right, so that's your number 81. All right, before we get to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, what's the best thing you watched this week? And it was a short damn week. We did podcasts on Monday. Now it's Friday.
It was a short week. I was a little worried that I was going to have to say it was one of these bad horror movies I watched this week, but it was not. It was by far 2014's Paddington.
Oh, I love that. Good.
That movie is so heartwarming and so fun the entire way through. I'm not usually the type of guy who enjoys those like family oriented movies and the movies that are designed for kids that like the adults are there to watch too, but aren't like something like Shrek where it's like really raunchy humor and stuff like that. But Paddington is one of the best, most wholesome movies I have watched in a very long time.
There you go, everybody. I mean, and that's a good thing to hear from us, because we don't really talk about wholesome best movies at all. I actually didn't watch like anything this week until today. And then today I got off work at 2 and I just watched 3 movies back to back to back. And all 3 of them are great. I watched Wings, which is the first Best Picture winner ever. That was great. That was so much better than I thought it was going to be. Cause it's the only silent movie to ever win Best Picture. Like the only fully silent, cause The Artist is like silent, but it was so much better than I thought it was going to be. And it just came up on Canopy. And then I watched My Neighbors, The Yamadas, which was a Studio Ghibli. And I didn't think I was going to like that one at all, but I actually thought it was really good at capturing small moments. But the best one I watched is I'm watching Ghibli in order, and then the one after that is Spirited Away. And Spirited Away, it doesn't quite live up to the ridiculous hype that it has, but I thought it was a great movie. And it's not as good as Princess Mononoke, in my opinion. But it was definitely one of those movies where I was like, all right, they're just having fun with it. Like, it kind of reminded me of 12 mm-hmm. Monkeys and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where it's you're going to get out of that movie what you put into that movie. And if you overthink that movie, you're going to come out of that not enjoying it. And I was actually surprised that the way the story and the plot and everything went, that people – that it has such universal acclaim as it does, because it's friggin' weird. And I always feel like people like to nitpick that kind of thing and like, well, we'll find a way to complain about it. But I guess it's popular to like it, so everybody likes it. But it was great. That was the best one I watched this week. But luckily, we'll have a little bit more time. Not that I'm really going to have much more time before the 21st. Hopefully, I can get like 3 movies in by then. But that's it. So Spirited Away and Paddington. So 2 children's movies in air quotes here, because I don't really think Spirited Away is much of a children's movie, despite what they tell you. All right, my number 81, we're going to Who Framed Roger Rabbit from 1988, my second Robert Zemeckis movie, and I think by far the best Robert Zemeckis movie. Now, a lot of people probably disagree with me on that. This movie is impossible to make. This was an impossible task to take on. And for them to take this on in 1988, before we really had this technology to do this, and to do it in a way where I think flawlessly they're blending these 2 elements in a way that looks better than half the CGI you would see in the early 2000s, late 90s, you know, and they did it so well. And they didn't do it with like A-list talent. Like Bob Hoskins wasn't a household name. The woman who plays Dolores, I don't even know her name. Christopher Lloyd was only coming off of being in Back to the Future. Like if it hadn't been for Back to the Future, Christopher Lloyd wouldn't have been a household name. But I love the concept that they went with here with taking things that are actually real, you know, like Dumbo, mm-hmm. taking things that aren't real, taking Marvin Acme, which we all know Acme, but then also taking Maroon Cartoons, which is fake, and taking all these stereotypes and all of these flaws of early cartoons and all of these flaws of early Hollywood and making like a scathing statement about how racist and like xenophobic Hollywood was in the 40s and making a movie that's about cartoons killing people. I think it's totally fascinating. I love film noirs. And I think if you don't love film noirs, this movie might not be for you, but I love film noirs. And I love that everything is done straight face in this movie. And that's a really hard thing to pull off. Cause I think if you don't do this movie straight faced, then you get that crappy Melissa McCarthy movie that came out that I can't even think of the name of with the stupid puppets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really interesting looking at this movie because I think it had to come out in 88. If they waited another year or two, this movie doesn't come out, which is unfortunate because it does have a very good grasp on the racism that was in Hollywood in the 40s and everything, and like permeating throughout 1988 and still with Hollywood and everything like that. But it has this really good allegory for racism. It has a very interesting mystery around it where you're trying to piece things together. Personally, I feel this movie is better in concept than in execution. But it's also it's really neat seeing these Disney and Warner Bros. Characters on screen at the exact same time.
Yeah, and I love the execution and just to like go through, like, this was a movie I always watched as a kid, and I don't think I realized that it was actually a good movie. You know what I mean? Like, you have those movies as a kid. I loved watching Batman and Robin, you know, like that the Mr. Freeze, baby. And so I would watch that one. And then as I got older, like, I didn't watch it for years. And I sat down and I watched it, and I was like, holy shit. Like, there's something here. Like, that was not what I expected. And then I was like, I think it was like a month later, I sat down and I watched it again. And I said, wow, there's lines in this movie like tunes. And then he drinks his whiskey after we see this running around. We have a baby smoking a cigar, calling the woman with the long legs that we don't even see her face, toots. We have what's wrong with him? Oh, Toons killed his brother, dropped the piano right on his head. Like, all of these moments are done with a completely straight face. And I think that because of that, I just appreciate that execution a lot, because you know the whole time that Doom is the bad guy, because it's not hard to figure he's the Snidely Whiplash villain. But you're trying to figure out what's going on with all of the other characters around him. And this is a total riff on Chinatown. It's a total riff on the Humphrey Bogart movies from way back in the day. And it really is a great, it's not just a great satire on film noir, though, in my opinion, it's a great satire about cartoons and the obsession cartoons have with violence and with like over sexualizing things that shouldn't be over sexualized. I mean, you think about it, Betty Boop with the I Still Got It, Badoop Badoop, and you're like, oh, that's cute. And then you think about it, and you're like, Betty Boop was a cartoon from like the 30s and 40s. What the hell is she doing wearing that in the 30s and 40s? Like, we couldn't even get. Like, if a woman had like a her top off and was wearing long underwear, people would lose their minds and that wouldn't fit the code. But Betty Boop's dancing around because she's a girl. It's just funny. Like, and I think it's such a good satire on all of that. Jessica Rabbit and Roger Rabbit. And then you get Acme and Bob Hoskins' character. Like, they're all just leaning into it so hard.
Yeah. And that is what this film does really. This film makes a very good, or does a very good job at making you think about your perceptions of things again. And in this case, it's really the way cartoons are, are how we appreciate cartoons, how we've seen cartoons, and the fact that cartoons are kind of rooted in this violence, and how once you take it and make it so the cartoons are actors and not just imaginary characters, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, this is insane. That they're going through all of this like horrific violence all the time and being having fridges dropped on them and needing it dropped on them 12 times because they have birds circling their head instead of stars.
Well, and it's kind of like what Toy Story did for toys. is like what this movie did for cartoons, where it humanized them. And you never thought about that, but we're a whole generation that grew up thinking about, well, do our toys come to life at night? Kids in the 60s and 70s and 80s didn't care, and that's why they would attach bottle rockets to them and shoot them up into the air. They didn't care. And I think that kind of fell out because we grew up with Toy Story, and I think this is an interesting take on – we laugh all the time when the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote are chasing each other and blowing each other up, and everything is so violent, over the top. And trust me, I watched those cartoons growing up. I have never had a violent urge in my freaking life. So, like – I don't believe in the whole canceling of those things or making it so that the cartoon's 3 minutes long. Keep them there. It's a time capsule. It's something to look back on and go, what the hell? And plenty of kids grew up with that and didn't become murderers. But it is funny that that's what it was. And you don't think about it because you're like, aha, like Tom and Jerry. Jerry's going to outsmart Tom again, and Tom's going to electrocute himself and whatever. But then you have the line from the director of, I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about the refrigerator. And that might be the most Hollywood line of all time, because like you would see if you work at these places. I mean, every time you see a horror story about this person got in a car accident or something like that, there is a studio behind that. And I will say this openly, and anybody who wants to come at me on this, I'm ready. But there is a studio behind that saying, shit, how much is that going to cost us? While this person, we don't even know if they're stable yet, but there's somebody saying, how much is that going to cost? Are we going to be behind on shooting now? And that's like what this movie is addressing, and it's doing it in a subtle enough way, but also in a very apparent way. And I think it does a good job of towing that line, because 1988 isn't that much different from 2021. I don't care what people say. I don't care if people tweet or put on Facebook or anything like that. It's not that much different. And down to the little lines of who needs a car in L.A.? We have the best public transportation in the world. They were joking about how shitty it was to live in L.A. in 1988. It's a million times worse now. It's only gotten worse in the last 33 years. But, you know, anyway, continue.
No, and that, again, is one of the crazy things about movies and how they age. And this one's particularly because it's set back in the 40s. It's removed enough that we can give that sense of that suspension of disbelief with it, where we can really buy into this movie, that this is what's going on around us. It's very tongue in cheek at times, and it's done with enough realism that you can believe everything that's happening there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can't really remember the first time I saw this movie, but I'm sure I thought about cartoons very differently after watching it for the first time.
Yeah, and it becomes that odd couple with Bob Hoskins and Roger Rabbit, because, you know, we'd never seen a human interact. I mean, I don't know if we had. Maybe we had in was it The Incredible Mr. Limpet or whatever it is. Like, that had that type of interaction, or it had the animation and the live action. But we'd never seen, like, such a buddy movie. Like, I always think about the handcuff scene. I look for the flaws in the handcuff scene, because you should be able to see where Roger Rabbit's arm is too small. They did such a great job with the design of that, that you really believe that Roger Rabbit and Bob Hoskins are talking to each other. And then when the weasels come in and the weasels are all interacting and stuff, like, you really believe, like, you at some point in this movie, you turn off the fact that they're cartoons. Mm-hmm. And you actually are like, yeah, that's just the character who he happens to be talking to at this time. Like, it is what it is. And especially Jessica Rabbit, who is so human, even though, you know, the Barbie doll type human, but so human, you start to, you completely tune out that she's a cartoon half the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things this film does really well. And it just presents things in a way where, it's the humanization of characters. And that's a really important thing when you're dealing with non-human characters. And it's what a lot of movies nowadays fails to do properly.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the scenes that always gets me in this one, and it ultimately ends up leading to nothing, but after Jessica Rabbit goes in and slaps Bob Hoskins around, or maybe it's the scene after he catches her with her pants down. Dolores comes in, Bob Hoskins and Jessica Rabbit. He doesn't have his pants on. So he chases her out Jessica Rabbit leaves, and then he chases Dolores out. And he gets to Dolores, and Jessica Rabbit's in the taxi. And she leans forward, and she has this look on her face like, I'm about to do something. I'm up to something.
Hmm.
And they do such a great job of creating this femme fatale when a lot of movies have a hard time even creating a good femme fatale. And they're doing it with Jessica Rabbit, who's not even a real person. And I feel like just that one little look there, you say, oh, she's up to something and it's not good. And I'm waiting for the other foot to drop. No, ultimately, she ends up being a good person and ends up being a good character. But later on, when she kidnaps Roger Rabbit and puts him in the back of the trunk, you're saying to yourself, well, wait a second. What is she up to? What is Jessica Rabbit's ulterior motive? Because we see her playing patty cake, which also to me is one of the funniest things ever, that when he's going patty cake, patty cake, patty cake. Oh, Jessica, patty cake. Like, come on. It's so ridiculous. And again, it's just so straight faced. But we know that she's cheated on Roger Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
So now what? And so I think they do a good job of creating that femme fatale and having Dolores kind of be your straight character in the bar.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it, a lot of it, the biggest thing, like you said earlier, is that we have this buddy film aspect between Bob Hoskins and Roger Rabbit. And a lot of that comes from Bob Hoskins' character sucks most of this movie.
Oh, he sucks.
He is,
I love him,
terrible. He is such a filthy racist for the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you sit down and watch this movie and just replace the word tune with a different word, and you understand how dire the situation is in this movie.
But again, that's why I think this is such a perfect satire, because think about Chinatown. And Chinatown was also satirizing the era, too, and pointing out the racism of the era. But one of the most memorable parts of Chinatown from a dialogue perspective is the quote, and I quote, the Chinaman joke, which is brutal. But he doesn't even say Chinese. He says Chinaman. Mm-hmm. And like, that's what Bob Hoskins' character is a reflection of in this. And I think that's what's so appealing about what this movie is doing, is that even though it's got cartoons running around and you have this big boob cartoon who everybody can't take their eyes off of, and you have Dumbo and Mickey Mouse and, oh, you're better than Goofy. Don't worry about it, baby. You're better than Goofy. You have all those things. But Bob Hoskins' character is very much a serious reflection of these private eyes that we grew up loving, these private eyes that Hollywood couldn't get enough of, who were just blatant racists and horrible people, womanizers, racists, alcoholics. And what is Bob Hoskins? He's all of them. He's just not good looking enough to be a womanizer.
Yeah. And Bob Hoskins' character is actually kind of where I find this movie falls a little flat too. I find that his character is dynamic. He obviously evolves throughout the movie and becomes a much more reasonable person towards the end of the movie. But I feel like a lot of his character moments don't feel earned to me. And a lot of that comes down to the moment where he's like, what is it? This man's been wrong. Or I don't take cases for tunes. But, you know, a man's been wronged and I have to fix that. And it's like, well, where's this coming from? Because that aspect of his character, to me, needs to be developed before that point in order for us to see why that would supersede his hatred of tunes.
Well, and so which part are you talking about? Because obviously at the beginning, the reason he gets into the reason he follows the job is because he gets the money. And then he gets handcuffed to Roger Rabbit because Roger Rabbit's in the house. So he doesn't have a choice but to continue on. And then he starts to change when it comes to Doom. And I think a lot of this comes from Dolores, who's trying to convince him. Is like, so which part specifically are you talking about?
That is the point, actually, because it's the conversation with Dolores. It's right after Jessica catches him with his pants down. Like, that's the scene where he's like, I have to go figure this out. And Dolores is like, I thought you didn't take cases for tunes. And he's saying, a man's been framed and I have to figure out what's going on.
You know what I think it is? And this is, I mean, maybe I'm interpreting this wrong, but the reason it never bothered me, I think it's because a really hot woman who's a cartoon just told him, to look into it further because it's her only hope. That's that's a lot of the style. If you go through any film noir, it's pretty much as soon as a very hot person, no matter if they're on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from our main character, that is they just can't help themselves. They can't help themselves.
That's a very good point. And I never really thought of it that way. And maybe that's just that piece that's missing for me to justify this change in attitude from Eddie Valiant.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be it. I don't know why I couldn't think of Eddie Valiant either. I think the names in this are hilarious with Eddie Valiant and Marvin Acme's hilarious, Maroon and anyway. But yeah, so like I can see that, but I do think that I think there's enough there, and I think all of it is with his vices. It's all his vices until Maroon actually dies. And then when Maroon dies, that's when it flips and it's no longer about his vices. And now it's actually about trying to do what's right. And that's when he actually goes to Toontown. And we hear the whole time that he'll never go to Toontown. And again, if you're telling me this isn't a satire, and you're not. But if this isn't a satire of Chinatown, like what is, where he literally won't go to Toontown because his brother got a piano dropped on his head. And even the scene where he's talking about what happened in Toontown is very reminiscent of Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway laying in bed together while Jack Nicholson's talking about Chinatown. It's so friggin' spot on. And that's when I think when he actually goes into Toontown, I think that's when he has totally shifted. And now he actually is doing it for the right reasons and not just for the money and the booze and what all the debts he has to pay off.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is definitely one of those most defining moments of him where he's actually working to save Roger at that point. Even though he thinks Roger just up and left him.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. But he still feels like once, what is it? He hears it from the taxi or something. Where does he? Yeah, he hears it from something like that. And then we have the totally disturbing scene in Toontown with the woman chasing after him, which is horrifying. But I also like all the little tropes in there of now Bob Hoskins has Toon rules. Eddie Valiant has Toon rules. He's floating in the air. He has the parachute. Oh, here's a spare. And he gets the rubber tire. Ain't I a stinker? I love all those little things. You know, I really do. I love all those little things. All right. So I'm trying to think. So in terms of like the world though, and like what I like about this world too, is when we go and we're watching them perform, and we're watching Daffy Duck and Donald Duck perform. If you notice, the entire audience is human. And it even said humans only at one point.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they're only white humans. And I tried to look for that this time, but I think it is such like a punch in the face of you racists that it's like, and then the tunes are serving them while the tunes are performing. And to me, it just nails that, like, you know, Hollywood like always is so proud of itself and always saying, oh, we're best for change and blah, blah, blah. But there's so many serious issues with Hollywood that really need to be addressed. And all these years later still haven't been addressed. And this is one of them, in my opinion. And I think it's really funny that like, Robert Zemeckis and team are taking this in 1988. And I mean, there's plenty of really racist comedies that came out in the 90s. That's for sure. I mean, that's what the 90s were known for. So,
yeah, it's really interesting to think that this was in 88. And even following this, people still didn't get the point. People didn't get the point that those races. And like another thing that people can slam this movie for, but I actually think is really well done in this movie, is Doom's motivation. Because Doom's motivation of building a highway is so indicative of the racism towards black communities when these major cities are being developed.
Yeah, I know. And so it's like so I always think about like Doom is very similar to Samuel Jackson in Django Unchained, where it's like he has found his way to not associate with what he really is. And now he's working with the enemy. And so Doom is walking around giving the Toons the dip and trying to build the highway to wipe out all of Toontown. And it's almost like he's trying to wipe out his roots. because he doesn't like what he was. And we see at the end when he goes crazy and his eyes get red and he gets the high pitched voice and he really loses it. It's like he's trying to be so opposite of all of that. And look at me, I'm the good guy here and all that. I mean, yeah, the highway building is a classic. And I also love the little lines from Eddie Valiant here. Nobody's going to use that. Why would you use a freeway? You know, and then Doom says traffic jams will be a thing of the past because, yeah, the 10 lane 405 never has traffic jams. Don't worry about that. Just really, like, I don't know. I agree with you. It's like it's very like what he's trying to do is very much like, hey, I'll go become somebody else in another community and pretend I'm higher up than I really am because I just want the power. And then I'm going to wipe out anybody who could possibly ever bring up my past and bring me back to it.
And that's what's really interesting about this movie is like this idea of Doom's really trying to erase his heritage. And Eddie Valiant gets to the point where he's trying to embrace other people's culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, Eddie Valiant kind of has to act like a Toon in order to save the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has to go into Toontown and do it. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have any Robert Zemeckis movies on your top 100, right?
No, I've actually realized after rewatching Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I'm not a big Zemeckis fan.
Well, so this is something that I was going to say. So I'm always fascinated by Robert Zemeckis because I love Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I love Back to the Future. Everything else I don't really like. I really like Forrest Gump. If I hadn't seen so many movies, would have been in my top 100, but I've just seen too many movies. You know what I mean? Like Forrest Gump is a movie that I have no problems with. I know a lot of people don't like that movie now in retrospect, but I like it. I always find Zemeckis to be fascinating though, because Zemeckis, out of all of the Hollywood directors of the era that he's been around for, I would argue that he's taken the most chances out of any of them. And he's constantly trying to evolve the medium. He's trying to keep moving forward with, you know, he has this movie, Polar Express, which is friggin' awful, but he's still trying to do something else. Forrest Gump is a totally unique storytelling perspective. Castaway with just one person on an island, that's very unique. He's always trying to do something very unique. And sometimes it really works, you know, and I think Flight was really good. I think it works in Forrest Gump, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future. And then you get other times with like the Women of Marwen where it's like horrible, horrible. It doesn't look good. It's terrible. Polar Express. It looks awful, but he's always taking those chances. And so I have a hard time with Zemeckis because now, like, you know, we're doing this 100 now and probably in 5 years when I do this, Back to the Future will be off my list. Who Framed Roger Rabbit is to be on there, but Back to the Future will probably be off because I've just seen other movies now. And, you know, I've watched like 150 movies in 150 days at this point.
Yeah.
And so he's going to drop off. And so I'm left with Robert Zemeckis and being like in awe of him and appreciating him a lot, but also finding that he has so many duds for such an unbelievably successful and unbelievably talented director. And it's funny how when he is good, I feel like he can be one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
But when he is bad, you can't believe that this is a director who won Best Director at one point.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. And I think a lot of it comes down to Zemeckis takes a lot of risks with his stories, but not a lot of risks with his film.
Mm.
And I think that's a big thing is that, yes, he takes these storytelling risks where we have things like Back to the Future was kind of this type of comedy we hadn't really seen preceding it. Who Framed Roger Rabbit obviously is this huge achievement with animation and live action together. And Castaway, of course, is this big thing with like single man in the cast.
I forgot about Beowulf too. Beowulf, he tries to do that Beowulf, weird with the weird animation.
Mm-hmm. And like he has these weird storytelling things like Contact, which is actually probably my favorite Zemeckis movie if we're being honest here. And like Forrest Gump has this different narrative with like the different time periods and everything like that. But if you look at the way all of his films are shot, they're all shot the same way. He doesn't experiment with the way he's shooting the films at all. And I think that's kind of where a lot of my appreciation falls off for him. He does really well with storytelling concepts, But he just seems to fall flat when it comes to experimenting with how he's shooting a film.
Yeah, because like a movie like Allied is a very generic, like, it's just a very generic war love story. It really is. And so, no, I get that. I get where you're coming from with that. It's hard for me to put a finger on it because, like, I don't know if I said this on podcast or off, but I think Scorsese at this point is overrated. I think we've kind of hit a point where, like, if you really watch a Scorsese movie, unless you're talking Taxi Driver, like, a lot of his movies have just been overblown to an extent that it's like, but I don't hate any of his movies. Hugo, I hated. I think Hugo's a steaming pile of shit. But other than that, I don't hate any of his movies. Zemeckis, like, I will not watch certain ones of his movies because they're so bad. But then he has some that are like, you know, even if you're not going to sit here and be like, oh, I love Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I love Back to the Future. If that's on TV, you'll probably leave it on. Like, if you're flicking through, you'll probably leave those movies on, even if they're not your favorite movies. But, like, The Polar Express, you're not going to leave on. Welcome to Marwen, we're not going to leave on. Allied, you're not going to leave on. Like, and it blows my mind. It just blows my mind. Because has there ever been another director like that? Where, like, Castaway is a very good movie, in my opinion, but not, like, amazing. But has there ever been another director like that where it really, like, his movies are either, like, loved or absolutely despised? They're not, he doesn't have an okay movie.
I mean, there are some. I mean, someone like M. Night Shyamalan comes to mind when you're thinking about that, where he does have two absolutely incredible movies and then a whole lot of stinkers. But, and like, they come up once in a while. The problem is like, I think with those type of directors, we don't really realize it because we talk so much about their achievements that people kind of forget they make like six films in between them.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point too, because if you think about it, like, I don't know what Zemeckis actually made, but it went from, it was 85, 88, 94, and then Castaway was 2000. There had to be movies in between there, you know?
Yeah, Contact.
Contact, oh, that's right, 97 was Contact, yeah. And then, yeah, there's a lot of directors like that where you might pick out their big ones, but that's also why, like, people like Fincher or Kubrick, who who you might really appreciate, they don't really have the duds because they just took their time with it. They'd wait the 5 years. Iñárritu, I think, for me, is like that. And I know he had Birdman and The Revenant back to back, but for the most part, he really takes his time and he'll just he'll make the movie when he feels like he's ready to make the movie. And some directors don't do that. And while they might have really great movies, they're going to have a lot in between. That's just not. And, you know, I think it helps though. And nowadays people look forward to when a Wes Anderson movie comes out or a Paul Thomas Anderson movie comes out, because they come out every 3 years. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think we're seeing that more with some other directors coming out. I think some of these like smaller studios are really promoting some directors a lot more than others. We're seeing it with like the Alex Garlands and the Robert Egers and those type of directors. And we're seeing that, but it's really interesting when we look back at the annals of film and we're talking about these great directors. They're not the directors who are pumping out a movie every year. We're looking at someone like Tarkovsky, who has what, 7 films or Kubrick, who has 9, like these monsters of directing. They pick and choose the projects they're working on, and that's why they have their lasting legacy.
Yeah. No, that's true. And I wonder what Zemeckis' will be when he eventually does, like, you know, he's 69 years old now. I'm sure he's not going to be making movies that much longer. And I'm curious what his is going to be, because Terry Gilliam's another great example of that. Terry Gilliam started out hot, and he fell apart. And it got to the point where, like, he couldn't get movies made. I know you have Dr. Parnassus as, like, a let's watch it movie, but none of his movies that came out probably after 12 Monkeys are nearly as well received as those first bunch. And then after that, it just kind of fell off. And that's kind of Zemeckis. I mean, he came out firing with Back to the Future and Who Framed Roger Rabbit and then Forrest Gump. And I mean, you know, Flight was a really good movie, I thought, but it's mainly because Denzel Washington is just an amazing actor.
Yeah, it's really interesting looking at these, and it's going to be a really interesting trend to follow as we continue going through this top 100, because I know we do get a lot more concentrated in our directors the further into this list we go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We definitely start hitting a little bit more of specific people. So, but that's let's wrap this one up tonight. So as I said, we're not going to be back. That's our 20th episode. We're not going to be back until June 21st. So 16, 17 days off, whatever time it is for you. It's 1:08 in the morning on June 5th for me. But we're not going to be back until June 21st. I hope you're enjoying this entire series. I hope you're paying attention to what movies we're watching, and I hope you're enjoying watching them alongside us. When we do come back, we're going to be going into number 80 for each of us, which is Burnt by the Sun from 1994 for John and 20th Century Women from 2016 for me. So two movies that I don't know if they're going to be very similar. I don't really know what Burnt by the Sun is about, but I don't think they're very similar. But that should be a pretty good podcast to come back to, and not a bad time to go on a little hiatus here, being that we just got through another set of 10. And if you're wondering, you know, okay, in the last 10, if you haven't been paying attention, I'll just go through the last 10 that we've done just so that you know, so that if you're interested and you haven't watched, our number 90 was Up and Queen Margot, but in reality it was Gladiator. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong one. It was Up and Master and Commander, but John actually had Gladiator at number 90, but we did Up and Master and Commander, so we talked about 89, we did Fight Club and Cabaret. 88, we did Annihilation and Atonement. 87, we did Jackie Brown and Stand By Me. 86, we did The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo from 2011 and La La Land, despite the fact that I actually had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but John has that higher. After that, we did Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri and The Hunt. Then Trainspotting and Delicatessen, even though I did have 7. Sinister and 12 Angry Men. Last week, we did The Room and La Notte. And then tonight, for number 81, we did 12 Monkeys and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So if you haven't listened to some of those, go back and listen to those. You know, if you want to get from 100 to 91, go ahead, listen to those too. I hope you listen to all of them. But if you're just tuning in, or if you just discovered this because I hashtagged Disney and somehow that helped, go back and listen to some of our last ones so that you can you have a little bit of time now to kind of catch up and get to where we need to be so that you can get into our number 80. And like we keep saying, it's just going to keep getting better every single week, because we like these movies more than the last set of movies. So next week, or not next week, but next time on June 21st, Burnt by the Sun from 1994, 20th Century Women from 2016. John, you got anything that you want to add to this before I get out of here?
Yeah, let's just remind our listeners that the week following that, on the 28th, we will be talking about Three Colors Red. So probably a good idea to watch Three Colors Blue and Three Colors White beforehand. Not necessary, but just gives you a better idea of what's going on.
Yeah, that's definitely a smart move, John. I totally forgot about that, but thank you for that reminder, because you're going to now have 17 days before our next podcast, and you're only going to have a week between that podcast and us talking about Red. So, you know, rather than having to watch all three in one week, you could probably get two of them done in this next span and then only have to watch Red that following week. They're heavy. You're not going to really be excited to sit down and watch White after watching Blue. I'll just say that. So, it's a heavy movie, but yes, Red is coming up. So make sure to be ready for that when that comes out on the 28th. But anyway, that's all we got. Thank you all for listening. For the people who actually tuned in live, thank you for spending your Friday night into Saturday morning with us. I'm going to go to bed because I'm exhausted. But as always, Jay Millsip and PWood43 over on Letterboxd. I've been making lists like crazy just to give some organization to my life. And that's it. I will see you all next time. We will see you all next time on June 21st with our next episode of Movie Buff Specialist. Bye, everyone.